The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Today on the show, we speak with a Ukrainian lawmaker visiting recaptured parts of her country and learning about what happened under Russian occupation.
In Balaklaya, we found a room where they were torturing our citizens.
Also today in Somalia, there's a looming drought. Al-Shabaab terrorists are making things worse.
They are preventing people to exercise their livelihood activities, including the farming.
I'm Marco Werman, and if you visit the Philippines, people there will say you must eat at Jollibee's. But you might not have to travel halfway around the world for the popular Filipino fast food.
Starting today, we will make Times Square more joyful with Jollibee's!
Real Philippine cuisine and burgers today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thank you for joining us. The world's top diplomat had some ominous words today on the state of global cooperation.
The solidarity envisioned in the United Nations Charter is being devoured by the acids of nationalism and self-interest, by a shocking disregard for the poorest and most vulnerable in our world.
The acids of nationalism and self-interest, so said the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He delivered a call to action today for world leaders who will start arriving at the UN General Assembly in New York next week. This is a time of great peril, Guterres said. He had just returned from Pakistan, where he saw damage from massive floods covering a third of the country.
And what is happening in Pakistan demonstrates the sheer inadequacy of the global response to the climate crisis and the betrayal and injustice at the heart of it. The world's most vulnerable, who did nothing to cause this crisis, are paying a horrific price for decades of intransigence by big emitters.
Guterres offered a pointed critique of the world's richest nations. Members of the G20 produce 80% of global greenhouse gas emissions.
If one-third of G20 countries was underwater today, as it could be tomorrow, perhaps they would find it easier to agree on drastic cuts to emissions.
Let's turn to one example mentioned by Guterres in his remarks today, Somalia in the Horn of Africa. Somalis are seeing their worst drought in more than 40 years. The country is on the brink of famine. The UN says it needs $1 billion to prevent it. One thing that's making the humanitarian response extremely difficult, terrorism. From Baidoa, Somalia, the world's Halima Gikandi brings us more.
A United Nations convoy is passing through Baidoa in south-central Somalia. Troops from the African Union are providing security. They are stationed here because of Al-Shabaab. The Al-Qaeda affiliate has waged a deadly insurgency against Somalia's government for more than a decade. The group's operatives lurk in nearby towns and control entire swaths of territory not far from here. At a camp for internally displaced people, Lisho Iman Ali is helping someone who just arrived to build a temporary shelter. There's no food, no water, no medicine, Ali tells me. She says she left her home 3 months ago, in large part because of this drought, but also for another reason. Ali says there was no security in her village because of Al-Shabaab. She says the group demanded that she cover herself more conservatively, but she didn't have the money to buy new clothes. Fearing for her safety and out of food, she fled her home. Ali tells me she's lucky if she eats once a day at this camp, and that meal might just be some tea. Sometimes she has to beg for food for her and her family. She holds up an infant, showing me his faint yellow hair, a sign of malnutrition. My child is sick, she tells me, but I don't have money or food. Ali is one of the thousands of people who are caught between two crises right now, drought and insecurity. Abdirahman Abdishakur is Somalia's special presidential envoy for drought. He says al-Shabaab is making it difficult to help communities affected by this drought.
Al-Shabaab, they are the ones who are causing the humanitarian disaster, because they are preventing people to exercise their livelihood activities, including the farming.
He says al-Shabaab is also targeting humanitarian workers. A week ago, militants attacked vehicles carrying food aid. At least 20 people died, including women and children.
It is tragedy, really, because people are already suffering the impact of the drought, and they are doubling the suffering.
Somalia's new president has taken a hard line against terrorism. He says his government is prioritizing the fight against al-Shabaab. Some humanitarian workers are quietly worried that this could be a distraction at a time when the drought is putting so many people in immediate danger. But Abdishakur says he disagrees. He says the security threat needs to be addressed.
Unless we remove that security threat, it is extremely difficult to save those who are dying because of hunger.
This week, Abdishakur traveled to New York. He's there to request that the United Nations and the international community do more to help Somalia get through this drought and to prevent a famine that could be only weeks away. Abdishakur tells me that Somalia also needs more than emergency humanitarian aid.
Our long-term goal is to break free from this constant cycle of suffering, hunger, and crisis. Billions of dollars have been spent on aid in our country, and billions more will be spent until we got beyond emergency measures.
He says Somalia needs financing to help communities become more resilient to climate shocks. One of the short-term solutions already in place is changing what farmers grow. Mohamed Ibrahim is with the International Committee of the Red Cross in Mogadishu. It's been helping farmers in hard-to-reach areas and giving them drought-resistant seeds that can go longer without water.
With the drought-resistant seeds we have been distributing, they were able to go back to their farms and able to produce even in this difficult situation.
At the IDP camp in Baidoa, I meet Fatuma Osman. She's sitting outside of her makeshift home holding her infant son. I ask Osman if she thinks receiving seeds would help her situation. After all, she farms for a living. Yes, it would, she says, but it still depends on the rain. And right now, the upcoming rainy season is expected to fall short for the fifth time in a row. Osman says if the rain does come and end this disaster of a drought, she would want to go back home. But right now, she is focused on keeping her family alive. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi, Baidoa, Somalia.
Today, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky made a surprise visit to the country's freshly liberated northeast. Zelensky helped raise the Ukrainian flag over the key city of Izyum. He thanked the troops for ridding the area of Russian occupiers. Ukrainian soldiers say their counteroffensive is not finished, though, and that they're still retaking towns and villages across the region. Mariana Bezugla is in eastern Ukraine. She's a member of parliament and deputy head of the Security, Defense and Intelligence Committee in parliament. She described to us what they are finding in newly retaken territories, including evidence of torture. And a note, some of this interview may not be suitable for all listeners.
Now I'm in Donetsk region, and it is not liberated. It's one of the most problematic. Before, I was in Kharkiv region while working with military to help and to oversight.
When you were in the Kharkiv region, what evidence had you seen of how the Russian troops withdrew from towns in the northeast? I mean, does it look like it was an orderly withdrawal?
You see, it was like panic. They left a lot. Ammunition, they left a lot of different evidence, materials, documents, and what is worse in the war, they left also places where they were torturing our citizens. I went with military personal while the liberation was just going on. In the middle of the process, when everything was very fresh, and with the defense and security forces, we entered cities. And for example, in Balaclaya, we found a room where they were torturing our citizens, where our citizens were kept there, and different evidence of this.
What was the evidence? What suggested to you that torture was happening in these places?
Just imagine, you are entering an underground room, and here it contains several rooms inside. One room is just obviously a room to keep people. Other room, there is a chair. On the chair is a hammer. On the wall, there are different papers with fake theories about Ukrainian Nazi. And on the next wall, you can see some kind of instruments where people can be hanged. And you are entering another room underground, and you see some blood. And it's rather obvious. While seeing this, I made some photos. We were, of course, very careful to be sure that evidence will be kept in intact way. And police now is working intensively on this case. And they have already found evidence that not less than 40 people in one moment of time were in such rooms in Balaclaya. So I cannot say more just now because, of course, it's a matter of investigation and the work should be done.
So you said you saw signs of where people might have been hanged. Will the evidence you gathered be used to construct a case of war crimes against the Russian military?
I suppose yes. Even I'm sure that now we can say that there are additional evidence that some people were killed, some tortured, also taking into account that they are working closely now with the International Criminal Court.
So you also said the Russian soldiers left behind ammunition and documents. What were among those documents? Anything incriminating?
There, for example, were papers with family names of our citizens they were looking for. So the overall picture was that in panic, they went out very quickly.
In the town of Kupiansk where you visited, did any of the residents speak with Russian troops? And what have you heard about their morale?
Yes, of course. We talked with our citizens. They were very thankful and in some kind of euphoria. Some of them were afraid of the overall situation. Of course, counterintelligence teams, they are working now to see if there are some citizens. They were working with Russians or there are some Russians which are masking like our citizens and so on and so on.
I understand there were some collaborators in these Ukrainian towns that were liberated, and some of them have tried to flee to Russia. Is that correct?
Of course. Many people, which is minority in the Kharkiv region, but many of them just escaped with Russians.
Will those people be welcome to return to Ukraine?
I doubt.
How would you describe the morale and state of mind of Ukraine soldiers now?
Of course, exhausted, but the morale is high now. And even those soldiers, those military, which are here in the Donetsk region, for example, in those such towns like Bakhmut, the psychological climate is very different comparing a week ago.
Mariana Bazugla is a member of parliament from President Zelensky's Servant of the People Party. She's also deputy head of parliament's Security, Defense and Intelligence Committee. She joined us from eastern Ukraine. MP Bazugla, thank you very much and stay safe.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Jollibee is the biggest Asian fast food chain in the world, but calling it the McDonald's of Southeast Asia, some do, does not do it justice. As the world's Patrick Nguyen reports, Jollibee is a source of pride where it started in the Philippines.
Jollibee has dreams of global conquest. The company's vision? Opening enough restaurants to break into the world's top five food chains, joining the ranks of Burger King, KFC, and Subway. The Jollibee Corporation is now in 13th place, but expanding rapidly.
Starting today, we will make Times Square more joyful with Jollibee!
Jollibee came to Times Square in August. This week, it opened a store in Philly. There are about 70 Jollibees in the U.S., but over the next few years, they want to add 500 more. For many non-Filipinos, Jollibee is their introduction to Filipino food. I called one of America's most celebrated Filipino chefs to ask about that.
Nothing beats Jollibee, in my opinion. It's just, it hits home so hard, you know?
Tom Cunanan helped to open Bad Saint, a D.C. restaurant credited with making Filipino cuisine hip in the U.S. I caught him on a break working at his new spot in Houston, Soy Pinoy.
The moment you walk to a Jollibee, it's just like the first impression for everyone is just like, holy crap, this is like the Philippines, you know, seeing our mascot.
The mascot. He's a big, happy red bumblebee, chosen by the founder because, in his words, he wanted to depict Filipinos as jolly and busy as a bee. Jollibee started in the Philippines 44 years ago. Cunanan says the place brings waves of childhood nostalgia. But what about the food?
In terms of flavors, like, I just think, like, the spaghetti. You know, like, when everyone tries to mimic the Philippine spaghetti, they try to mimic Jollibee spaghetti.
That's right, fast food spaghetti. Jollibee sells burgers and fried chicken, called Chicken Joy. You dip it in gravy. It also sells palabok, rice noodles topped with pork, shrimp, and garlic sauce. But the spaghetti might be the cult favorite.
Jollibee spaghetti. The meatiest, tastiest, spaghettiest spaghetti.
Jollibee spaghetti is very sweet, made with a special ketchup derived from bananas. Add ground beef and sliced hot dogs, and top all that with cheddar cheese. Filipino chef Jordan Andino says it's not the spaghetti most Westerners know.
However, anyone else who has a good palate, regardless of where they come from, is going to understand that it balances sweet and savory, and it also has a great umami.
Umami is a Japanese word describing a delightful savory taste. Andino runs a restaurant called Flip Sigi in New York. Full disclosure, he was once in a Jollibee commercial, but he says he really does just love the food. Jordan Andino says if anyone sees burgers and spaghetti on the menu at Jollibee and wonders, is this Filipino food? They just don't know the culture.
Jollibee is without a doubt Filipino food. And honestly, anyone who says differently is just speaking heresy.
Philippines has been repeatedly colonized by Spain for more than 300 years, then by the United States for nearly 50 years. So yeah, they do adobo rice and cheeseburgers too.
Filipino food is an amalgamation of mainly three different types of cultures, Spanish, America, and Chinese. That's where we get all of our inspiration, our ingredients, even some of the general practices that we live by.
Both chefs I spoke to feel that Filipino food was, for too long, ignored, even disrespected. But Jollibee is on an expansion spree. It's growing in the U.S. and Europe and starting to push into Australia, China, and Japan. Again, here's Chef Jordan Andino.
It shows that we can, from a humble third world country, we can keep up with the KFCs, the McDonald's, the Subways of the world. And that's why Filipinos are so proud of it.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
On the central coast of Peru, construction is underway on a massive new port. A state-owned company from China is doing the work, a joint effort with the Peruvian government. Experts say it will be a milestone for shipping and trade between China and Latin America. The world's TV Saizea has more.
Chancay is known as a sleepy fishing and farming town about 50 miles north of Peru's capital, Lima. It's been popular with tourists and birds that migrate every year to and from North America. But now this little town of about 60,000 people is where a huge commercial port and industrial zone are being built. Construction began last year and has already radically changed the area. Costco Shipping, a state-run company from China, has invested $3 billion in the project.
We've seen a number of acquisitions of ports by Chinese companies in the past, but this is the largest that I know of in the Latin American region.
Margaret Myers is the director of the Asia and Latin American program of the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank in Washington, D.C.
In the case of Peru, a lot of this trade would be in copper, but also would potentially be a port that would accommodate goods from wide-ranging other countries, including potentially agricultural products from Brazil. So would be critical, you know, for China to be able to transport goods, especially these goods that are critical to China's energy and food security.
The port in Peru is part of China's Belt and Road Project, a global infrastructure plan to boost China's international trade routes. Chinese leader Xi Jinping launched the effort in 2013. Myers says the political winds in Latin America are shifting in China's favor.
A lot of these countries are welcoming of Chinese engagement more in the way of trade and very much see China as a critical economic partner.
Peru's new deep water port will have the capacity to serve the largest cargo ships in the world. In a recent visit to Chancay, President Pedro Castillo said the facility will help Peru's economy and position the country as a major player in international trade.
Hay que traer la tecnología. Hay que traer desarrollo a nuestro país.
We need to bring technology and progress to our country, he said. The government says the project will generate 1,300 construction jobs and 5,000 permanent jobs once it's finished in 2024. But people in the town of Chancay are not happy. Miriam Arce lives a few miles away from the port, and she says people there are seeing their lives changed forever.
Nuestro mar, nuestro litoral peruano, está concesionado a manos privadas.
Our beach, our coastline is now in the hands of private companies, she says. We can't enjoy them anymore. Arce says she used to listen to the sound of waves and seabirds. Now, this is what she hears 6 days a week. This is from a video Arce recorded from her home. Construction workers are using demolitions to flatten the terrain where there used to be a hill. They also place huge cement piles on the shore to contain the waves. Arce says tourism is non-existent and fishing is not possible anymore. She says the Peruvian government never carried out an independent environmental impact study. Residents are getting the equivalent of $150 a month from the Chinese company, but Arce says that's not enough to find a new place to live for people who will be displaced. So she's now organizing residents to demand reparations.
Nosotros somos un David y ellos son Goliath.
But we are David and they are Goliath, she says. The town of Chancay will never be the same. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Sri Lanka is struggling under the weight of its debt and hoping for a bailout from the International Monetary Fund.
This idea that there might be something that can save us, I think that is bringing some sense of relief.
But it's going to take a lot of belt tightening to get that assistance. And we look at why Azerbaijan and Armenia are fighting again. Coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A meeting of two global powers is set for tomorrow in Uzbekistan. Russian President Vladimir Putin will sit down with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. It will be Xi's first trip outside of China since the start of the pandemic. The leaders will be in the city of Samarkand for an eight-nation conference, a gathering that's widely viewed as a symbolic counterweight to Western cooperative organizations. The other participants are from South and Central Asia and include India and Pakistan. To get a preview of what's on the agenda, we turn to Erica Marat. She's an associate professor at the National Defense University in Washington. Of course, Erica, everyone wants to know how Beijing may help Moscow wage war in Ukraine. Could there be any movement on that?
I don't think the war in Ukraine will be the major issue at the conference. I think China and Russia will focus mostly on security questions in Eurasia, in Central Asia, and countries surrounding Central Asia, including Afghanistan, Iran, China and Russia.
What are you expecting to come up at these meetings and come out of these meetings?
China does not want Russia to conduct military campaigns or to even hint at the possibility of military campaigns like Russia is involved in Ukraine in Central Asia. And Xi already said as much in Kazakhstan when he met with President Tokayev that without naming Russia, he said that China will support Kazakhstan's territorial integrity no matter how the international situation changes. So that's China's signaling that China will limit Russia's presence in Central Asia in the coming years.
How would you describe the Chinese-Russian relationship right now?
It's complicated. So China supports Russia as long as Russia is in competition and challenging the West. But China will not support Russia if Russia will try to launch similar campaigns, military campaigns in Kazakhstan, let's say, or to increase its military presence in Central Asia. For China, it is important to be the dominant actor in Central Asia. So there will be more tensions between China and Russia if Putin will try to resurrect Soviet Union, let's say, in Central Asia, the way he is trying to do it in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, China does want to see the West challenged, but I mean, could they provide Russia with weapons if Russia asked?
I doubt that China would provide weapons to Russia. I doubt this is in the plans, because then it would be a more direct, a more straightforward support of Russia's imperial war in Ukraine. What China could do is further undermine Russia's influence in Central Asia by providing weapons potentially in the future to Central Asian countries.
So if Russia and China forge closer ties, is that a worrying sign from Washington?
It is, of course, in Ukraine, and maybe even in places like Afghanistan or Iran. But there is only so much that Russia and China can agree on in other parts of the world, in Central Asia, South Caucasus. There might be a lot of disagreement. Or in Africa and Latin America, Russia and China have really different roles to play, and Russia is a much smaller actor compared to China's economic power and ability to influence domestic politics in different parts of Africa and Asia.
Mm. Erica, what are you most curious to see emerging from this meeting tomorrow between Xi and Putin?
Definitely interested in how much both Putin and Xi are on the same page when it comes to security in Eurasia and Eastern Europe. I am curious also to see how much anti-Western rhetoric they will voice, whether it's direct or veiled rhetoric. And I'm curious to see how much both leaders or either leaders will take away from those meetings for their domestic audiences. For Putin, if he's able to create an image of someone who is not an outcast, international outcast, marginalized by the West, but who has international friends and important friends. And for Xi, that he is back to raising China's profile internationally now by finally getting outside of China and traveling again. It's also important to remember that smaller actors of the members of the organizations like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, they're also looking for what is in the interest of their national security, and they will try to broker deals with both China and Russia.
Erica Marat is an associate professor at the National Defense University, raising the curtain for us on tomorrow's meeting in Uzbekistan between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. She joined us from Washington. Erica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sri Lanka is struggling through its worst economic crisis in modern history. A series of fiscal shocks and policy missteps led the country to default on its debt in May. Widespread protests forced the ouster of the former president in July. Food prices have nearly doubled, fuel is being rationed, and there's a shortage of basic necessities like medicine. For months, Sri Lankans have been hoping for a bailout from the International Monetary Fund. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports on what exactly that will take.
At the beginning of September, the International Monetary Fund announced that it had struck a preliminary deal with the government of Sri Lanka for a four-year, $2.9 billion loan.
I was talking to people when that deal was announced, taxi drivers, people in stores. And
economist Shayu Damsingha says the mood was one of cautious optimism. He works at Frontier Research in Colombo, the financial center of Sri Lanka.
This idea that there might be something that can save us, I think that is bringing some sense of relief.
In the deal, Sri Lanka's government agreed to a slew of reforms to get the financing, increasing taxes, especially on higher income people, better targeting government subsidies to help the poor, and rooting out corruption. But at a press conference, the IMF's Peter Brewer emphasized one major condition for the loan to be approved.
For the IMF to go ahead with committing resources and lending, it needs to assure itself that debt sustainability is being restored.
What that means is that before the IMF will loan Sri Lanka that $2.9 billion, the country has to prove that it would eventually be able to pay off all of its other debts. So now Sri Lanka is going to its lenders.
We are telling our creditors, look, we don't have the money to pay you back.
Economist Shayu Damsingha again.
If you try to force us to pay you back, we won't be able to do that. So the only way we can pay you back is if you renegotiate the terms of that debt.
Like by saying, we'll pay you back, but at a lower interest rate. Or we'll pay you back, but later than we said we would.
What usually happens with country-to-country lending is that you push that into the future, essentially. So, you know, loans due over the next 3-4 years, you don't have to pay in the next 3-4 years, but only start paying after that.
One factor complicating all of this has to do with Sri Lanka's biggest creditor, China. Chinese lenders hold about 20% of Sri Lanka's debt.
What is clear is that China will play the key role.
Umesh Mormadaliya is an economist at the University of Colombo. He says this is the big question right now. How much is China willing to renegotiate the terms? Lots of other countries will be watching this closely. Over the past decade, China has made lending billions to low- and middle-income countries a big part of its foreign policy. And now, many of those countries are in debt distress, so they too might start asking China for relief.
So I think that's why they are concerned. It's not about Sri Lanka, because whatever the precedent that China sets here, China might have to follow that.
If and when Sri Lanka strikes a deal with all of its creditors, economist and think tank co-founder Anushka Vijayasinghe says there's another big hurdle.
Because after that, it has to go to the IMF's executive board for approval, and that's where things are going to get tricky.
Tricky because the most powerful members of the IMF executive board, like the US, Canada, and the EU, are going to be looking to make sure they're on equal footing with China.
And if there's any hint that China wants some preferential treatment compared to other creditors, there's going to be opposition to approving an IMF program.
IMF representatives won't say when money might start flowing to Colombo, but the fund's Peter Brewer said, we hope it can be quick.
It's important to move expeditiously. That really is the key here, because we want to avoid the crisis becoming worse.
Sri Lanka is struggling to regain some stability after throwing out one president and installing another. A bailout from the IMF, which was founded at the end of World War II to help secure financial stability, is a key part of that. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
This week, new cross-border fighting erupted between Azerbaijan and Armenia. More than 100 soldiers from both countries have been killed. The United States is urging the parties to cease hostilities. Richard Giragosian joins us from Yerevan, the Armenian capital. He's director of the Regional Study Center think tank in Yerevan. Richard, is this a both-sides situation, or in your view, is there a clear aggressor?
No, there's a clear aggressor in terms of, unfortunately, an overnight offensive launched by Azerbaijan targeting Armenia proper. Given the level of preparation and the intensity of the fighting, any kind of false equivalency is very unhelpful when we're looking at this particular escalation.
So the two countries do have a history of conflict over this contested region of Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian enclave inside Azerbaijan where war broke out in 1988 and in 2016 and again in 2020. That is not where this fighting is happening. Explain what's going on.
That's a good point, Marco, because what we see is an interesting paradox. On the one hand, the recent attack by Azerbaijan has nothing to do with Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian populated enclave. But at the same time, it has everything to do with this recent attack. In other words, Nagorno-Karabakh as an unresolved conflict is a lingering, festering wound for Azerbaijan, which was unable to retake the enclave after the 45-day war of 2020.
So why is this happening now?
First and foremost, a combination of the perception and reality of Russian weakness. Russia is the major player on the ground in this South Caucasus region, but Russia admittedly is overwhelmed, distracted by its own failed invasion of Ukraine. So in this context, Azerbaijan sensed an opportunity and moved quickly to actually increase the pressure on Armenia by militarily attacking. The second driver of the timing, equally interesting, was a recent gas deal between Azerbaijan and the European Union, where Azerbaijan has contracted to export important natural gas supplies to Europe as an alternative to Russian gas. But for Azerbaijan, it feels a sense of leverage over the European Union, which emboldened the country to attack Armenia.
So Armenia and Azerbaijan have a history of fighting, as we said, but what history of diplomacy do the two countries have?
Well, during the Soviet period, as we all know, the countries have a long history of living peacefully as neighbors. But the real problem was Armenia and Azerbaijan went to war over Nagorno-Karabakh during the Gorbachev period. In other words, this particular conflict erupted in the closing days of the Soviet Union, which meant that the conflict itself tended to distort democratization and development, and also to change the trajectory of statehood and economics. So where we are is dealing with a burden of the past, a legacy.
So what do you think is the best hope for a resolution of this conflict, a conflict with long historic roots?
I think the best resolution is no resolution. In other words, it's much more effective in terms of adopting a policy to defer and delay a final outcome of Nagorno-Karabakh in terms of status until things calm down.
And when is that going to happen?
Well, that's a good question. And in general, I think true democracy and economic development outside of Armenia and in Azerbaijan is almost a generation away, given the extent of corruption and authoritarianism. But I'm still justifiably optimistic, because there's only one way forward for everyone. And the real difference now is, for the first time, economics and trade are accepted as genuine incentives for peace. That's been a missing ingredient in the past.
Richard Giragosian is director of the Regional Studies Center think tank in Yerevan, Armenia, helping us understand the new fighting between Armenia and its neighbor, Azerbaijan. Richard, thank you very much. Good to speak.
Thank you.
Moshra Leila, the band from Lebanon, has been selling out shows around the world. The group is arguably the most popular alt-rock band in the Middle East. But to fans' dismay, those days are now over. Recently, on the Beirut-based podcast Sarday After Dinner, lead singer Hamed Sino announced that the band is breaking up. The group has been together since 2008, but members say online harassment and a stifling political climate in Lebanon is making it too difficult to continue. Sino has been called the most prominent openly gay rock star in the Arab world. Moshra Leila often sing about gender equality and homophobia. That led to the band being banned in Jordan, then at a 2017 show in Egypt. Someone in the crowd waved a rainbow flag. Many concertgoers praised the move on social media and posted pictures, but what followed in Egypt was a crackdown on LGBTQ people across the country. They were condemned by authorities for inciting debauchery. Moshe Leila was subsequently banned from performing in Egypt. In 2019, a gig in the band's home country of Lebanon was also canceled. The reason there? To prevent bloodshed after band members got death threats on social media. Lead singer Hamid Sino says the stress got to be too much. Fans have been showing their support on social media with messages like, "This is a tragic end to an era," and "Moshe Leila will always be iconic." Three murders within Israel's Arab communities rocked the country last week. The incidents sparked nationwide condemnation over safety issues in Arab cities. Arab Israelis make up just over 20% of Israel's population, but in recent years they account for more than 70% of all homicide victims. From Israel, reporter Yoshi Fields has a story of the roots of the violence and what people are trying to do to change things.
Violence and crime has become a main concern for Arab Israelis, or as many prefer to be called, Palestinian citizens of Israel, even more so than the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The number one issue in the Arab society is this security issue.
That's Maysam Jaljouli, a leading activist on these issues.
When you walk out of your door, the feeling is that you might not return.
Victims are often innocent people caught in the middle of criminal gangs, family or blood feuds, or extortion tactics used by the mafia. So where are we going first?
First to the Samhet neighborhood.
Ola Najmi Youssef is an expert on crime in Arab cities. She drives me through the city of Lod, where Manar Hajjaj and her 14-year-old daughter were killed last week while unpacking their groceries from their car.
The murder was here in this street, behind the police station.
It's thought that the murder had something to do with a feud between the father and another family. As we drive, Najmi Youssef nervously tells me,
"I don't want to make us unsafe."
The streets are narrow. Piles of garbage take up the open spaces where kids might have otherwise been able to play. One of the main reasons for the increasing crime rate, she says, is a lack of investment by the government in the communities. Underfunded schools, high unemployment, limited housing, lack of bank branches. The poverty rate for Palestinian citizens of Israel is much higher than in the Jewish community. As we speak, we're interrupted.
Students that they have to cross this.
The town is separated in half by train tracks, about 7 or 8 tracks side by side. There's no bridge for people to cross safely. To Najmi Youssef, it's just one other example of how city planning didn't take into consideration Arab neighborhoods and cities. She tells me people are getting roped into crime in many different ways. Sometimes it's because they can't get a loan at a bank and then turn to the black market. And other times because they simply don't see another alternative. Much of the violence involves young men.
You don't have a path in life. Many of them don't have even dreams.
That's Khaled Sayed. He works with an Arab youth organization called Baladna. About a third of Palestinian and Israeli youth between 18 and 22 are neither in school nor employed. These kids, he says, grow up in a country that constantly reminds them that they don't belong. In this context, criminal networks provide a sort of structure and a way to feel powerful.
As something that gives status in society, gives money.
Beyond poverty and a lack of opportunity leading to crime, many residents also bring up the troubled relationship they have with the police. The other murder last week was of Nidal Agbaria, a prominent and widely respected Arab-Israeli journalist who was shot dead in his car in Umm al-Fahim, an Arab city in northern Israel. In a video, reportedly from the scene of his murder, a fellow journalist, Hassan Shalan, can be heard shouting at the police.
Busha! Busha!
You should be ashamed of yourself, he says in Hebrew. You come to the crime scene and take pictures without doing anything.
Arabs are shooting. Arabs, the police didn't do anything because they don't care. They actually don't care.
That's activist Maysam Jaljouli again. Last year, it was reported that the police solved only around 23% of the murders of Palestinian Israelis, compared with around 71% for the Jewish community. The lack of trust in the police is compounded by the fact that as Arab society is changing, people in the community are no longer going to their imam or elder to sort out disagreements. With no trust at the state or the police, Jaljuli says, crime bosses have filled the power void.
A lot of people really go to this crime organization in order to help them solving the problem.
In October of last year, authorities approved a multi-year plan to fight crime in Arab communities. The wide-ranging plan aims to tackle the mistrust in police, add more stations and officers, as well as curb unemployment and provide education opportunities. There's already been some significant progress, including large busts of illegal weapons. In a statement, Omar Barlev, the public security minister, noted, quote, "The crime families in Arab society are holding the entire Arab sector by the throat." He stressed that it's an issue for the entire country. However, police also say that the rate of unsolved murders is partly due to Palestinian citizens of Israel's refusal to share information with them. Jaljuli actually agrees and says that the trust between Palestinian citizens and police is indeed completely broken. But she emphasizes the deep-rooted culture of the police that needs to change.
Because when a policeman see me as an Arab woman, he will not think to serve me. He will think that I maybe came to do a terror action.
The state's relationship with its Palestinian citizens is tinted by the larger Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She gives me a small example about a time when she was looking for her son at a park in Tel Aviv. She ran to the police to ask for assistance.
I said his name is Wissam.
An Arab name. And suddenly the officer's tone became stern. He asked,
"What are you doing here? Why did you come to Tel Aviv? I'm looking for my child, and this is the question." I told him, "I don't need your help. I will find my child alone."
Back in Lod, Ola Najmi Youssef says that despite this type of treatment, they can't afford to play the blame game.
If every side will just put the responsibility about the other sides, we will not have the good way to talk together.
She says that there are grounds for hope, though. In her work, she noted, for example, just a few years ago, the Arab community had been strongly against increasing police presence in the Arab cities. But now, most support it. Najmi Youssef urges patience and cooperation.
It's have to take the time to see the result in the ground.
Omar Barlev, the public security minister, has echoed the sentiment. Just last week, he noted that, unfortunately, quote, "years of neglect require years of correction." For The World, I'm Yoshi Fields in Tel Aviv.
Check out our latest stories at theworld.org, including our ongoing coverage of the war in Ukraine. The mayor of Lviv sat down with our reporter Daniel Hoffman to talk about how the city is dealing with a large number of displaced people. Meanwhile, Ukrainian hospitals are in overdrive, providing care for people injured by Russian attacks. And medics on the front lines are taking care of their mental health after six straight months of combat. Those and other stories at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston at GBH and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you right again here tomorrow.